Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Allison Bektesh. Local clerks react to the Trump administration's request for voter records.
Scientists use technology like GPS to study biodiversity in Spring Valley above Carbondale.
Workers on J-1 visas come from all over the world to work at the Glenwood Springs Adventure Park.
And we sit down to talk with Edward Berkeley, the director of the Aspen Opera Center.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Supreme Court Associate Justice Elena Kagan headlined the inaugural Sandra Day O'Connor speaker series at the Aspen Institute Monday night. Allison was in attendance.
Justice Kagan and moderator Margaret Marshall, retired Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, took the Greenwald Pavilion stage to a standing ovation. The women spoke about the influence O'Connor had on their own careers as young attorneys. Kagan described O'Connor as a woman who liked to get her own way and advised young girls listening to replicate the determination of the first female Supreme Court justice. Kagan also offered insight into the closed-door deliberations held after the justices hear a case. She thinks the public would be pleased.
People's minds change, or people find alternatives that they didn't know existed by listening to other people. And so there's pretty vigorous and I think, really valuable debate and discussion.
Kagan told the audience in the sold-out venue that she believes all of the justices are able to keep their personal opinions out of their rulings and stressed that there are far more unanimous decisions than the court is given credit for.
To hear the full discussion, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
Earlier this week, Aspen City Council heard an update on studies of the town's risk for water storage. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, there is uncertainty about the uncertainty.
Consultant George Omek, an agricultural economist with Headwaters Corporation, is analyzing the risks to Aspen's water system. Omek said that his preliminary findings show that climate change presents the biggest risk and uncertainty. Aspen Municipal Water comes from Castle and Maroon Creeks. Omek noted that if there were to be a shortage, the first impact would be to the in-stream flow, which is intended as an environmental protection, not the supply of potable water to residents. This is the first of several presentations to council, and Omek said more data is necessary, including new gauges on both creeks to accurately measure flows. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Carbondale residents have expected a new city market for many years now, but the project has been kicked down the road again and again. Last week, it was delayed once again. Here's Joel Starbuck, who's on City Market's side of the deal, speaking to Carbondale's Board of Trustees.
At that point, I thought I knew something, and then the following day, I did not know something. So I'm waiting to know something.
The trustees granted Starbuck a sixth extension. It's for 90 days. Wyatt sat down with producer Kristen Kay to talk about the latest delay.
So Wyatt, what is Starbuck talking about there? What didn't he know?
What he didn't know is whether or not he's going to get the money that he needs. And to understand why this is, we have to zoom way, way, way out. On June 16th, Amazon bought Whole Foods, and this caused major disruption among huge corporate grocers and retail alike. So I think large grocers are just a little cautious right now in terms of investing money in new capital projects. So this comes at kind of an awkward time because the project is pretty much ready to go. It's all teed up. There's a complete set of building plans that have been approved by the town. And Starbuck has to come back to the trustees and say, I need yet more time. So please, wait with me.
There are city markets all over the place. How is this city market special?
The city market is especially important for Carbondale, and that's because the current city market makes the town a lot of sales tax revenue. In fact, it makes most of the town's sales tax revenue. But city market currently leases the building that it's in, and that lease will come to an end in about 4 years. The town wants a sales tax generator of that magnitude.
What happens now? What's to stop City Market from just asking for more extensions?
Well, Kroger and Joel Starbuck have until September 28th to close the deal. That's when the 90-day extension will end. The company that owns the property that the proposed City Market will be built on is called MSP3. They have about 24 acres there, and City Market represents only about a third of their project. So they have other things that they're going to do. They're going to build affordable and attainable housing, they say. They're going to have other commercial space. And they said that they are talking to other grocers. So If City Market backs out, it sounds like there's a good chance that another grocer might step in. I was talking with one of the partners of MSP3, and he made it pretty clear that their project is going forward with or without City Market.
Okay, so maybe some answers on this at the end of September.
Maybe.
Scientists know that sometimes to understand the big picture, you have to start small. Researchers in Colorado work to make sense of life in a changing world. And first, they're tallying what exactly lives here. Elizabeth Stewart Severy was there as researchers took inventory of Spring Valley life.
In the late June heat above Carbondale, it's dry and sneezy. Butterflies flutter through the sagebrush, stalked by teams of net-wielding students and scientists. John Sovel is a wildlife biologist with the Colorado Natural Heritage Program. He's caught a butterfly in his net, and students gather around with field guides, flipping pages to identify what exactly he has found.
I don't know what this is.
Okay, that might be in the distribution. Sagebrush, checker spot.
That was it.
Yep, that's it. Sagebrush, checker spot.
And another species is accounted for. Sovel is one of over a dozen researchers participating in last month's so-called BioBlitz on a 450-acre ranch in Spring Valley. Teams from Colorado State University, Colorado Mountain College, the Aspen Global Change Institute, and local experts took inventory of the living creatures on the property. This means at dawn, birders listen for songs, and another group checks small mammal traps. There's a sonogram to detect bats, traps set for insects, and botanists poke delicately through the sagebrush. There are several reasons for this blitz, but it starts with property owner John Powers, who's thinking about the future of his land.
Yeah, I want to do the best management I can here. You've got to start out knowing what you've got before you start changing things.
The land has been in his family for over 50 years. This is the second year that the Colorado Natural Heritage Program is helping him understand the diverse life this land supports. David Anderson is that program's director and chief scientist. He says this work goes far beyond one property owner. It's all about conservation.
Because we can't do any effective conservation until we have the science and the data to support it.
This intensive study is also meant to be educational, so it includes students from high schools in the Fort Collins area and CMC and CSU students, too. Through inventories like this, Anderson and his teams catalog Colorado's rarest plants and animals, and then set priorities about how to manage those habitats. And it's not always bad news. Take last year's BioBlitz in Spring Valley, for example.
We've also found a plant that is extremely rare. It's found in a very small part of the entire earth.
It's called the Good Neighbor Bladder Pod, a tiny plant with gray-green leaves and round pods. It's mostly found near Montrose, so finding it here means it actually has a much larger range than scientists originally knew.
We are starting to see that it's not as rare as we thought it was, and we have to get out there on the ground to learn those things so that we can set our conservation priorities.
And hopefully never have to work to list the Good Neighbor Bladder Pod as an endangered species. This type of inventory can also help set a baseline to understand how changes in the climate, water, and land use could impact life of all kinds. The Aspen Global Change Institute, or AGCI, studies just that. Spring Valley is home to one of a dozen soil moisture monitoring stations in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Soil moisture is a really key determinant of what plants can survive where.
That's Elise Osenga, a research coordinator for AGCI. She joined Anderson and others in the June BioBlitz. Anderson expects that the composition of species on the ranch, and across the world, really, will change alongside the climate. Detailed research like this provides both pieces of the big picture puzzle of a changing world and smaller triumphs. Participants recorded several species of birds and plants that they hadn't found last year. Birders heard the distinctive call of a hermit thrush, and botanists used GPS to map the range of that rare plant, the Good Neighbor Bladder Pod. Anderson says it's essential that this work happens now.
Our opportunities to advance conservation in the valley are never going to get better than they are right now. So the more we can learn right now, the better job we can do for creating a sustainable future for people here in the valley.
This year's inventory will wrap up after a few more field days in August. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm. Stay in the know with what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and like us on Facebook for news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. Colorado Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman hopes new partnerships will help protect the state's immigrant population.
The scammers promise to help immigrants navigate the path to citizenship and demand high fees for what they promise will be an expedited process. Though it is illegal for unlicensed consultants to charge for this service, the practice is still happening, but the crime is not being reported. Kaufman says victims are often taken advantage of by trusted community members and don't report the crime because of their undocumented status.
When someone says, someone who speaks their language particularly, we can provide legal services to you. It's easy for these folks to fall victim to that and to pay a significant amount of money for something that they desperately want and don't know or aren't comfortable trying to get on their own.
By partnering with local social workers and religious groups, Kaufman hopes to spread the word about the phony consultants, as well as another scam in which individuals are sold appointment times at the DMV, even though appointments are free.
Para la versión en español de esta historia, por favor, vayan a la línea aspenpublicradio.org.
Denver is the new home for the Outdoor Retailer Show. As Elizabeth Stewart Sevy reports, the move from Salt Lake City has both symbolic and economic implications.
Organizers estimate that the three annual industry trade shows, including winter and summer markets, as well as a snow show, will bring a total of about $110 million each year to Colorado and draw 85,000 attendees. The Outdoor Retailer Trade Show announced in February that it would no longer hold events in Utah because of the state representative's stances on public lands issues. Aspen Skiing Company Vice President of Sustainability Auden Schendler says it's a major statement from businesses.
This is exactly what business should be doing. It should be holding policymakers to account. And this is a great example of wielding power from the outdoor industry, and we need to do more of it.
The first Denver show will be in January 2018. Elizabeth Stewart Sevry, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
It's summer, which means that visitors and locals alike are flowing into the backcountry. This also means that Mountain Rescue Aspen is getting busier. News director Carolyn Zachariasen sat down with Jeff Edelson, president of the nonprofit, and speaks with Kristen Kay about that conversation.
Well, it is a nonprofit. A lot of people think that it's an arm of the sheriff's office, but it's not. It is its own independent organization. There's no staff. It's a 100% volunteer organization. But it does have a memorandum of understanding with the sheriff's office. And so when they are on a mission, they do work underneath the sheriff's office. They have about 50 volunteers. They cap it at that so they can know how to work as a team.
So there have been a lot of headlines about MRA rescues in the last few weeks. What did Jeff have to say about those?
Well, he did acknowledge that we've got a pretty steady start to the season. What he said was interesting, that of the 100 or so missions that they have, which 80% are between June and September, half of the people were unprepared. So either the knowledge of where they were, their skills, their ability, their fitness level, and then the other half were things just happen. Mm-hmm. Here's two examples. They happened back to back 2 weekends ago on a Saturday. We had an injured climber on the top of Snowmass Mountain, which is a 14er. He had a broken leg. And so they had to get a helicopter and drop off a team of four so they could then hike up 2,500 feet, administer medical care, and then put that person in a litter and literally carry him down 2,000 feet on snow and ice. And that took 6 hours.
Wow.
An hour before they got that call was a person who was unprepared and was at Crater Lake up by Maroon Bells and just had acute altitude sickness.
How does Mountain Rescue Aspen prepare for that potential influx of unprepared people in the backcountry?
So they have two missions. One is to save lives through backcountry rescue, and the second one is mountain safety education, how to be prepared. So what they keep pushing is, you know, carry things in your pack. Make sure you have rain gear. Make sure you have water. Make sure you have a little bit of food. Even if you're just going on a day hike, you never know what's going to happen. If you're going to go climbing, pick your route, know your route, and make sure that you tell somebody what your route is and what your estimated time is. And what Jeff also stressed was cell phones don't work out there, so don't rely on them.
Glenwood Caverns Adventure Park sits on Iron Mountain above Glenwood Springs. Its vintage Western look is easy to pick up on. The main plaza looks like the set of a John Wayne movie. What might be harder to pick up on is a small contingent of international workers.
Please keep your hands inside at all times. Do not put them up or out. You can hold on to the lap bar.
Monique Thorpe is operating the cliffhanger at the Glenwood Caverns Adventure Park. At 7,100 feet, it is North America's highest in elevation roller coaster.
Have fun! When I got off the first time, I felt sick, like somebody just beat me up or something.
Monique is from Jamaica. Roller coasters weren't really her thing when she started at the park 2 summers ago, but she tried anyways. New experiences are what she's here for.
Living in Jamaica is wonderful, you know, it's home, and but it's like your bedroom and you need to see the rest of the house.
Monique is one of 20 international students with the Adventure Park this summer. The others are from places like Norway, Slovenia, and Turkey. They're all here on J-1 visas. Decades ago, the program was created to foster cultural exchange, to get international visitors and Americans interacting. The current program has its critics. In 2014, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a civil rights group, concluded the J-1 program is, quote, little more than a source of cheap labor. They scolded practices like hiring J-1s as housekeepers, because that's not a job that allows for much of the intended cultural exchange. One of the Adventure Park's 20 J-1s does work as a janitor. Eric Brotherson is the HR manager for the Adventure Park and Iron Mountain Hot Springs. He maintains the position complies with J-1's guidelines.
The janitorial position at Iron Mountain Hot Springs is going to be roaming throughout the grounds, picking up trash, wiping down surfaces, getting a lot of interaction from guests. Hey, can you show me where the restrooms are, or the locker room?
Brotherson says the J-1 program gives the park access to labor when they need it. And the Adventure Park is not alone in this. There are over 4,500 J-1s working in Colorado this summer.
We're a very seasonal business. You know, our busiest time is going to be from Memorial Day weekend through Labor Day.
After Labor Day, the park stays open every day until the end of October. The local college and high school students have gone back to school, and this is when the J-1s are essential. But they also need to return to school, and coming to the U.S. can be quite the financial sacrifice. How much does it cost you to get here?
In total, maybe for me, it was maybe $2,000 US, give or take.
Brotherson connects with potential employees through recruiting firms. He tells the firms what he's looking for. They send him resumes. Once the J-1s are hired, they pay the recruiting firm a program fee. They also pay their visa, travel, and their health insurance. When they're in Colorado, they pay their food and most of their housing costs. The park guarantees a minimum of 32 hours of work each week. It also rewards them with an end-of-the-season bonus. But if they're not making enough, Brotherson says,
they're more than happy to go around town and find another part-time job.
Monique has a second job. A few nights each week, she works the register at 7-Eleven and stacks the shelves.
How many hours a week do you work?
Me, in total, I work about 40 hours here. Yeah, and 7-Eleven, maybe 20.
Despite the 60-hour week, Monique loves the J-1 program. She meets people from around the world. She experienced snow for the first time this past May.
At the end of the day, it is not about making back the money. It's about the cultural experience.
For Brotherson, the J-1 program is essential to the park's business model. If it ever went away,
it would be very difficult for us because they're a great resource and fantastic kids that hopefully take home great memories of this country.
Monique plans to travel when she's done with work this fall. She already has some elaborate plans for the money she saved working her two jobs.
This time, it's to do all the other stuff that I didn't get to do the last two times, the paragliding and the skydiving and maybe a trip to Vegas just to see what the hype is about, you know.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Allison Bechtesh. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
Colorado Secretary of State Wayne Williams has said he will comply with a request from the Trump administration to hand over all state voter data. Allison has been in touch with election officials and sat down with Kristen Kay to discuss what this means for local voters. She started by telling us what clerks in the Roaring Fork Valley think about handing over voting records.
Throughout the valley, the clerks wanted to stress exactly what information is being turned over. It's information that's always been public, and what gets turned over is a full name of a voter, the address they used when they registered to vote, their month and day of birth, not their year, and which elections they've participated in. But there are concerns about this, and actually the voter data was supposed to be turned over tomorrow morning, and that's now on hold due to lawsuits.
Mm. Tell me about those lawsuits.
Almost 20 organizations have filed lawsuits nationally. The one that's stopping us here in Colorado is a lawsuit filed by the Election Privacy Information Center, an independent nonprofit center that looks at elections. What their issue is there was no privacy impact assessment given by the commission that's looking for all this data. They haven't said how they will protect this data once it's turned over. And in fact, they were asking local Secretary of States to turn it over to a website via a website that's not even secure. There's also some bigger issues that's causing this to be a national conversation. The ACLU is suing based on more the integrity side of things. So the commission was set up under the auspices of let's just see how every state's doing elections and see if we can do it better. But we know that when President Trump created this, he was looking for voter fraud because he said that. He said that.
Or tweeted that.
Like 3 to 5 million people was his claim in this last election voted illegally. And then some states are refusing to turn over the data. He recently had a tweet. Why are states afraid of the voter fraud commission? That's the word he used for it. Are they hiding something? So there's this question of once the federal commission has all this data, what exactly are they going to use it for? Because we can't control once it's in their hands.
If the voter commission does move forward after the lawsuits and local voters don't want their data turned over, what can they do?
There is a provision for something that's called a confidential voter. You have to sign that you are in fear of bodily harm or threats, and that's why you're keeping your information private. So the other thing you can do is unregister to vote.
But then how do I participate again?
Then you don't get a vote. You have to be a registered voter to vote. So Eagle County Clerk Regine O'Brien's fear is that you won't then re-register to vote before the fall's elections and that this is disenfranchising people and making our community less civically engaged.
Interesting.
To hear more of the conversation, subscribe to our podcast, The Dial. Go to aspenpublicradio.org.
The state's Department of Transportation, CDOT, has presented nearly 60 times on the Grand Avenue Bridge closure. As Wyatt reports, a spokesperson presented earlier this week to a group of seniors in Glenwood Springs.
Kathleen Vonatovich describes her message as half pep rally, half encouraging people to be flexible for the 90-day period following the August 14th bridge closure. The talk was organized by Garfield County Senior Services. About 50 attended. Vonatovich says the audience was concerned with things like getting to their doctor's appointments on time and being able to keep their daily routines. She encouraged them to plan ahead. Some routines will have to change. The Traveler is a bus provided by Garfield County for those who can't access other forms of transportation. Its route will change during the closure. Riders might be asked to transfer to a Rafta bus to get where they need to go. CDOT makes presentations like these to grow public awareness and also to reduce traffic. They hope to get 1 in 3 cars off the road during the closure.
Edward Berkeley is director of the Aspen Opera Center. He's been with the Aspen Music Festival and school for well over 3 decades.
He spoke with arts reporter Claire Woodcock about the Aspen Music Festival and school's operatic production Giuseppe Verdi's La Traviata at the Wheeler Opera House.
Are there any scenes in particular that like stick out to you?
I mean, there's the first time that Violetta, who's the Traviata herself, and Alfredo, when they meet, there's an extraordinary toasting song that's very, very famous called Libiamo, and referred to as the Brindisi. And it's a remarkable scene because you see them discovering each other and he as well falling in love and realizing that this could be something major for their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty major scene. The other scene that's I think fantastic is the second scene of the second act, which is a big party scene when there's a confrontation between. This is after Violetta has left Alfredo, and Alfredo finds her at a gambling house, and condemns her for leaving him, and he throws money in her face, and his father shows up to say that he's an idiot. He has an idiot for a son who would do this kind of thing, and it's shameful. And it's a very operatic scene, and can be melodramatic, which I hope we're not, but that it also can be very exciting and moving, because she's already dying, which Alfredo doesn't know. And so he's condemning her for leaving him, but he doesn't know the reason that she was actually leaving him, to protect him and his family.
Okay. Tell me about what excites you about this opera, putting this opera on this summer.
One of the great things about being at the Wheeler is that vocally it's extremely friendly for younger voices, because it's about 500 seats. And it means that the singers don't have to fight. They don't have to really struggle vocally. I mean, they have to go over the orchestra, so that can take energy and vocal energy. But the house itself is very friendly acoustically.
What are your initial thoughts when opening night, when everybody's out on stage? Or do you just stand backstage and you're like, yes, we did this? Or is your process?
I'm up in the balcony normally, watching from the back of the house. And I'm relatively relaxed almost at all productions. And maybe it's just because I've been doing it for a while, but some of it is that I think what happens, and frankly the mistakes that will happen, because there will be mistakes, it's a human live event. So things are going to happen that are not what were planned. And I think that's one of the exciting things about doing opera, about doing theater, is that it is live. And so when I'm standing there, I'm rooting for everyone to do great, and not to make incredibly bad mistakes of some kind, or something, some kind of error happens. But it's also seeing the way your singers and your orchestra are able to adapt in a moment when something happens that you don't expect. And then I know for me as an audience member, and I think for a lot of audiences here, seeing that moment where something goes slightly wrong and you're aware, gee, that was different than maybe they planned or rehearsed, and then they figure out how to solve it. And I think sometimes those moments, I mean, it's what makes live events so exciting.
Opera can sometimes be considered kind of a polarizing art form. How is the Aspen Music Festival and school and the Wheeler together trying to bring in people to kind of break down that barrier?
Well, we have titles. So we always have titles. So that people should not, people who can read will know what's going on. I mean, that's clear. The other thing is that you're watching singers. Many of the roles in operas are for characters who are in their teens and 20s, and that's who we have as singers. So that you feel, I think people going to an opera at the Wheeler feel that they're watching people who would be having these experiences.
That was Edward Berkeley, director of the Aspen Opera Center and La Traviata, speaking with Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. The Aspen Music Festival and School's production of La Traviata at the Wheeler Opera House premieres Saturday, July 15th. For an exclusive behind-the-scenes look at the making of the production, listen to the latest episode of Curated on aspenpublicradio.org.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. To hear the show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Good afternoon. It's
you hold on.
Mountain Edition. No, you hold on.
Oh my God.
No, really, you hold on.